child was very sick, so she couldn't make it. And Honorable Nyakemba as well submitted an apology. No, I couldn't open the attachment because I was already on the way to the meeting.
Okay. So there are those are the only apologies. The rest, there are no apologies. There's a problem with attendance of this meeting. And there are people who are consistently not available for the committee, so we'll have to take this matter further with the whipperies of different parties for the members who are not attending our meetings. Thank you very much. Let me give over to the facilitators to take us through the presentation. Thank you.
Defeated by technology. Sorry. Chairperson, we got last week to the end of the presentation on the Labour Relations Bill. And before we proceed to consider the issues in the Basic Conditions of Employment Bill, I thought it might be useful to pause and see if there are any questions that have arisen since then about the Labour Relations Bill so that we complete that one before we move on to the basic conditions.
Okay. Okay, may I proceed? Sorry, Chair. Last week we learned that majority rights can be awarded to a union that hasn't got 50% plus one representation. Won't you just, for me as a layperson, explain what do you mean by the majority rights in practice? What is normally included in terms of that understanding that a union gets, you know, that special position of recognition as the majority union at the workplace? And what would then be the rights that you distinguish between that a minority union might have and that of a majority union? Thank you.
Honorable William.
Thanks, Chairperson. I just have a question around consensus at the NEDLAC processes with regard to the 6 month period that you talked on last week. I just want to know, is there consensus around that six-month period where people, with regard to contracts or the labor broker period, whether that six-month period was agreed upon by all parties? Thank you.
Any other comments then or questions? Let's skip over to
Chair, I'll just deal with that question of minority and majority rights. I think, as we explained last time, the way the Labor Relations Act works is that once you get to certain levels of representation, you can claim a right which you can get the CCMA to award you to organizational rights of certain kinds. It's just important to distinguish that from what you can claim, as in demand, that you want, because you can claim rights, whether you're a minority or a majority or whatever you are, you can claim those. But if you claim them without having an actionable right to be awarded them by a CCMA commissioner, you have to rely on persuading the employer, and there you can use strike action to persuade them. So the rights we're talking about, the amendments, are when can you claim as a legal right or entitlement that the CCMA, the commission, can actually give you those rights, whether the employer likes it or not. And then there are two categories of rights. There are those that require what is referred to as sufficient representativity, and those that require majority. and the rights that require sufficient representativity, and as we said last time, sufficient is not defined. It's for a commissioner who's presented with a case to decide, in this particular case, is this level of representation sufficient, taking into account a whole lot of considerations about the workplace that are set out in the Act. So sufficient representativity will gain you, a union with sufficient representativity can gain access to the premises for the purpose of organizing trade unions, can claim stop orders, which gives the union its membership dues and its income, and the third one is its leave for trade union representatives under Section 15 of the Act. So those are the three basic organizational rights that a sufficiently representative union can claim. As we said last time also, most trade unions will not only want that, they'll at least want an office to arrange it, access to telephone lines and so on. None of that is regulated in the Act. Then the two rights that are generally understood to, or that they can only claim as of legal right from the CCMA, if the employer is unwilling to give it to them, if they're a majority union, are the right to shop stewards, trade union representatives, they're called in the Act, shop stewards. And the second one, I think, is the right to information. Disclosure of information for the purpose of engaging in consultation or negotiation. So those two rights, what the amendments do is that they say, if you're a union that is less than a, effectively it moves that, that it shifts that minimum requirement of a majority union to saying you don't actually have to be a majority union. If you can persuade the commissioner that the circumstances are such that you should get those two rights, even though you're not a majority, you can get them, provided you've already got the basic rights, the three basic rights for sufficient representativity. So you must be at least sufficiently representative, and there must be no other union that's already got those rights in the workplace. And if you're sufficiently, at least sufficiently representative to enjoy the basic rights, and there's no other union that's got shop stewards or access to rights to information, the majority rights, then you can get those majority rights even though you haven't met the 50% plus one threshold. So that's basically that change. There was a second one that we discussed, and I'm not sure. That's, I think, the change you're asking about. The second one we discussed was that until now, under the current regime, once you have got 50% plus one as a union, you can demand that the employer actually agrees what the thresholds, representativity thresholds, should be in that workplace. And you conclude an agreement which says in this workplace you only get access or stop orders if you are 45%, for example. And that's a tool that a majority union can use to exclude smaller unions from organizing the workplace, effectively by forcing the employer to agree that it won't give rights to anybody less. And if an agreement like that's being concluded with a majority union, then the union can't go, the smaller union can't go to the CCMA and say, I'm 30%. There's this majority union agreement that I've got to be 45 for basic rights, but 30% is more than sufficient to get access and stop orders. I want that. But at the moment, the CCMA would then say, sorry, there's a majority agreement saying 45, and under the provisions of Section 18, I think it is, of the Act, that's binding on me. So the amendment says a commissioner faced with that kind of a case could decide that even though there's a majority union agreement setting thresholds, that the commission is not going to apply those thresholds and is going to give basic rights to a smaller union in conflict with the majority union's agreement. But then it must have given the majority union also an opportunity to argue the case in the CCMA before it decides to do that. So if you were talking about an Implats type of scenario, a commissioner would be quite worried about giving rights to a smaller union that didn't meet an agreed threshold with the majority union, because it would be concerned. One of the considerations that's always been in the Act is to say that the commissioner must take care to avoid proliferation of trade unions in the workplace, and is obviously going to have to be sensitive to workplace potential for workplace conflict, etc., etc., before granting organizational rights to a smaller union. So those will all be relevant considerations. But it won't any longer be the case, if this amendment is made, that the Act says to the Commissioner, you may not grant rights in those circumstances. The Commissioner could if he wanted to drop below the agreed threshold. Of course, even if the commissioner refused to grant the rights, it's not going to stop the smaller union from demanding them. The smaller union can still mobilize strike action or go on a campaign against the majority union or whatever it is. So inter-union rivalry is not eliminated, and I don't think it's necessarily created by this either.
Yeah, I don't think I'll add on to that, because I think that answers your question. Is there agreement on the 6 months? No, simply put. There is no consensus on it. Certainly business has wanted a much longer period, and Labour's formal position has been ban them.
You may have heard me ask this before. In terms of international practice or best practice or research, a period like 6 months, is that eventually now a negotiated position, or is it one that is really backed by international experience and research and practice?
Yeah, follow-up question.
Sorry, just on the same issue. What are the implications if, so fundamentally, if that six-month period is made into no months, it means that Labour brokers are completely finished. Is that the implication of making it, if you make it 0 months? Or will the, whatever they're called, employment agencies, will they still exist? I mean, is for instance, what, when it comes to the Labour's position of ban them, if you make the 6 months into 0 months, will that effectively do that job? That's what I want to know.
Right, let me come to the first issue. I think there is, I stand to be corrected, but there is certainly international practice in relation to temporary employment services. The extent of temporary is different. I'm not aware that the 6 month period has been drawn from a particular international precedent in relation to that. But I stand to be corrected. So it may, in fact, have become more of a negotiated position. But I'm perhaps we need to consult with someone like Paul Benjamin, who was also on the drafting team who came up with the 6 month proposal. I think as regards the zeroing it, in effect, you see, I think you've got to understand that Labour brokers perform various functions. And it is only the function that they perform where they remain the employer. All right, they remain the employer. So they place Chris at an organisation, but the TES remains the employer. That's the controversial aspect of labour broking. I mean, there are other aspects of labour brokering where they place you, but they don't remain the employer. They provide other services. There are a range of other things that the labour brokers do. So that's the controversial one, where they remain the employer. And we've called that temporary employment services. If the six is reduced down to zero, it would fundamentally constrain their activities to the point where they can't perform that aspect of their functions because they can't place anyone and be the employer. So in effect, it would have it would ban labour brokers in that particular function. That's what it would do. The question that's got to be raised there is the big debate has been around the constitutionality of that, And but you've also got to realize that one of the other compromises that has been put up by government is they've said, for the purposes of the LRA, the labor broker is the employer for only 6 months, and thereafter the client is. So in other words, for the purposes of the UIF Act, after 6 months, the labor broker remains the employer. For the purposes of the Skills Development Act, remains the employer. You see what I'm saying? So that is an issue there. Now, the reason why that was put in is if you're requiring, you know, maybe you put there for 7 months or 8 months, and you're requiring a change administratively in all of that. It's a highly, you know, administrative process to have to change the name of the employer for all of those particular categories. And the fact that, you know, the labor broker is the employer for the UIF is less controversial. It really, what the concern was from the likes of labor was in relation to dismissal, organizational rights, collective bargaining, all the issues that are covered by the LRA, but not by the other pieces of legislation. And he wants to prevent a situation where, you know, a farm worker, a seasonal farm worker, goes and works on a particular farm for 3 weeks and then moves to another farm for another 3 weeks and then another farm for another 3 weeks, and then you have to have three different employers registering for UIF as opposed to just one. Those kinds of things. So that was the motivation, I think, from government in relation to that area.
That would be, what will happen if, for instance, the months are reduced from 6 to 3 months? Will it make any difference in terms of the constitutionalities? Because you're saying that the reason why this thing is in place, if you take the 6 months away, there could be, you know, problems with the constitutional court and all those. But what if you have it from 6 to 3? Will it still have the same impact? Because those are some of the things that I picked when we were talking to other people about this. They say 6 months is just too much. Why don't you cut it to 3 months or zero? Because then it means you are allowing people to be exploited for this period of 6 months. You close your eyes and say, okay, you have a right to a job for this next 6 months. No one is going to assault you. You can still go to the CCMA if you feel this. But what about the salaries that people earn? How much should the labor broker keep? How much percentage should the labor broker keep of the money that is given to the worker? Because if the worker is paid 100 rands a week, the present situation is that in that 100 rands, the labor broker can pocket 70 rands and give the workers 80 rands. It's happening. Is there a percentage that is set? That's my question. Out of 100, you can keep this, and the rest goes to the employee.
If I can just try and answer that one for you, Chair, and then there was the other question, which was about international best practices, and I can maybe just try and refer to that one as well, because I think we haven't really dealt with that. But, Chair, at the moment there is no regulation of what percentage a labour broker can charge, but I think it's important to draw a distinction, and maybe it's one that goes to the heart of the emotiveness around the subject of labour broking. Labour brokers are not allowed to take money off the worker's wage. They're not allowed to take any part of their fee off an employee's wages. Or is that something we're putting in the BCA now? I think it already exists. You can't deduct anything from the worker's wage that a worker hasn't agreed to in advance. the general proposition, what a labor broker does is he charges the company that the services are being applied to. But if he charges the company, he might be charging the company 1,000 rand and for the worker's services and only paying the worker 800. But the workers, that way around, the worker's earning 800 and the labor broker's taking 200. But it's not of the worker's wage. Now, the significance of that is this. If it's in a regulated environment where, like a sectoral determination, which says you have to pay the worker a minimum of, I don't know what the sectoral determinations say. Some of them are extremely low. But let's assume that the sectoral determination says you have to pay a worker in this industry a minimum of 1,200 rand a month. I don't know what the security sector is. I think the security sector is about 12 or 1,400 or 1,500 a month, something like that. So if that's what the sectoral determination says, that worker has to earn that amount of money as a minimum. He can't earn that amount and then pay the labor broker. So what the labor broker has to do in that industry is charge the client. He has to mark up whatever that 1,200 is with his own fee and then charge the client that he's providing 1,200 plus his fee. So he can't pay the worker less than the prescribed wage. But that percentage isn't regulated, and it's an interesting question about when you come to a bill like the Employment Services Bill, which is still being negotiated, which is intended to be the regulatory instrument that is going to regulate the registration of labor brokers, because everybody actually accepts that labor brokers must operate in a regulated environment. Employment Services Bill. What did I say?
No, you said.
Okay. Employment Services Bill, yeah. So that bill, which is on its way, is going to determine what the conditions are for labor brokers to be allowed to register, to get a license to operate as labor brokers, and so on. So it's entirely possible, it hasn't been done yet, that you could specify that a labor broker may not charge a client more than X percent more than the worker earns. So if the worker earns 1,000, you may not charge more than 1,200. If you wanted to, that could be regulated there, but it isn't regulated at the moment. So in the short answer to your question, is a percentage regulated? No. But are workers required to pay out of their wages to pay the labor broker? The answer I would suggest to you is no. And if there's any doubt about that, it would anyway be made clear, I think, by the current provisions of the basic condition, the amended proposed amendment to the Basic Conditions of Employment Act, which is going to make it clear that nobody is allowed to take money off a worker's salary for finding them or providing them with a job. We'll come to that clause in the course of today's session. But anyway, I don't know, Anton, maybe you should have, I was just going to talk about international precedent. I don't know if you want to add to this question. Actually, international precedent is quite diverse on this issue, and it might actually be useful at some point to put a paper out of some kind. I'm looking at one that Paul Benjamin actually prepared at some point in the process of preparing the initial regulatory impact assessment study, where he looked at international labor standards and how this issue has been regulated over the years. And what you find is quite diverse practice of regulation. If you look at Europe and the UK, which are looked at probably because our employment law is quite closely assigned, they say the regulation of triangular employment, that's what this is, triangular employment, has been one of the most controversial issues of labour market regulation within the European Union. In 2001, there was a working directive that was opposed by the UK government. Then they broke the deadlock and agreed on various things and agreed that equal treatment would kick in for workers of labor brokers. And once equal treatment kicks in, then it seemed to solve a lot of the problems. Then there were various things like that happened that regulated in the UK. Then he deals with Germany, where there's a different way of regulating it. All employment leasing agencies must be registered. Those are labor brokers, must be registered to operate legally. The contract's void if they're not. The Act used to disallow in Germany employers from repeatedly entering into fixed-term contracts and set a minimum period of 24 months, but that was now being abolished, and the principle of equal pay obliges temporary agencies to pay the employees the same as for client companies. And then there are two exceptions to that rule. And what you find in each country is each country's built up a whole series of rules with periods and exceptions that try to regulate and prevent abuse in that is suitable to their own economies. The Dutch model, apart from an initial period, which in major collective agreements is 26 weeks, that's about 6 months. So the Dutch model has got an initial period of 6 weeks, but after of 6 months, but after that they are guaranteed continued employment by the labour broker. So the labour broker can't just say after 6 months of using a temporary worker, sorry, I don't have a job for you anymore. They have to provide them with a job. Then there are various other ways they work there. They give an initial 26-week phase, and then you can prolong that by collective agreement to 1 year, and then there's phase two, and then phase three after 12 to 18 months of employment kicks in. So that's the Dutch model. They've got a whole series of graduated periods when your rights increase as you go longer into employment. And then you can even compare the Czech Republic's model for dealing with it, and Poland, and China, and Korea, and various, you know, this sort of work has been done. But if I were to sum it up for the committee without going into all of the detail, there is no uniform norm of regulating these things. It has been recognized as a major issue internationally. In all international comparative jurisdictions, it's not actually a South African issue, although we have our own unique history and economic history that might impact on labor broking. It's a problem globally with the way in which the global economic system has resulted in vertically disintegrated enterprises with lots of companies all contributing to one factory in some way or other. And so internationally, jurisdictions and legal systems have had to try and work out how do we protect workers within this. And for the most part, they've come up with systems of identifying stages in which you gain greater protection, because they all tend to recognize that a certain amount of flexibility is important, and that there are early stages of an employment relationship when the employment relationship may not have been established, and it may not have not a worker may not have become part of the enterprise, but after certain thresholds or periods of time are met, then the workers have the same sort of protection or rights as others in the enterprise, even if they work for different employers contributing to the enterprise. So as a general high level, that's the kind of theme that runs through the regulation in all of these sort of countries that I've mentioned. And if any of you wanted, I'm sure that we could make available. I just need to ask Paul if this is the latest version of his research on that, on the global experience. So.
May I just add to it? I think we kind of engaging now in the policy debates, and I'm reticent to engage in the policy debates because we the drafting team, but bearing in mind that I think the concern is that labour brokering, certainly at the lower levels, for workers, has created a two-tier labour market system, in the sense that labour broker employees are paid much less than the client employees. And it makes no business sense for an employer to bring in a labour broker and pay more in wages and fees to the labour broker than he or she would to his or her own employees. So the way in which the labour broker makes money is by decreasing the wages of the workers and taking a slice of that. But it's not a deduction from the wages in and of itself. They're paid lower, and then that the labour broker is paid, and that's where you have this two-tier system. And I think the other concern is that labour broker employees remain temporary. And that actually has a, while there is no specific issue of regulating temporary versus permanent in our labor law, it has major effects in the labor market because temporary workers generally don't get benefits and they can be more easily dismissed because they're generally on a kind of fixed-term contract and they don't have access to pension, provident, medical aid, those kinds of things which generally more permanent employees employed by the client have. So that's the key problem or the business model that has been created.
Just to add that point, because it is one area in which there actually is consensus between the social partners, I believe, which is that long-term employment, workers shouldn't be employed in long-term relationships that are deprived of benefit or equal benefits or equivalent treatment or whatever it is. The debate, the real debate is business saying that the first 18 to 24 months there shouldn't be those that equal treatment rights. I think I just wanted to put a line in the sand that everybody, I think, accepts that after a period you can't use temporary employment relationships to regulate. Let's just take it as a two-year cutoff. I think everybody accepts that beyond 2 years you can't treat workers who've been more than 2 years in the enterprise as having less security of pay or benefits or whatever than others. The real debate is whether there should be what the run-in period should be. Sorry, Anton. Just wanted to identify that as a point of consensus.
So what has been introduced within Section 198, now this would apply to all employees, irrespective of whether you're above or below the threshold, is this 4C, all right, 198-4 capital C, which says that an employee may not be employed by a temporary employment service on terms and conditions of employment which are not permitted by this Act or any employment law, sectoral determination, or collective agreement concluded in a bargaining council, and then the operative words are applicable to a client to whom the employee renders services. So you can't have now another situation where an employer outsources, in essence, their transport to a labor broker and then says, okay, now those employees don't fall within the metal industry. They actually fall within the transport industry. So the applicable terms and conditions are the transport industry, and therefore they're going to be paid much lower than what it is in the metal industry. You can't have that kind of... They've got to pay the metal industry rates. Do you see what I'm saying? So they get a labor broker to do the transport, they get a labor broker to do the catering, they get, you know, those kinds of things. And the labor broker says, I'm not in the metal industry, I'm in a different industry. They can't do that anymore. It's what's applicable to the client. So that is a very, there's consensus on that. So that, I think, is a very important thing, development, because it will then prevent this two-tier type labor market systems within one company arranging. And it will, I think many employers will now say, well, is it really worthwhile using a labor broker in those circumstances? Because I actually have to pay the same wages as I'm paying to my employees, and I have to pay the labor broker's administrative fees. So, you know, there's that scenario. The second scenario is, as I understand it, the six-month scenario, there is all of this international stuff that you have a look at, but I'm not aware of 6 months being an international precedent out there. I think they're different varying periods. I'm not quite sure how 6 months was arrived at, but it was seen as a kind of more reasonable period. I think that's how government perceived it. Certainly, labor had pushed for a lower period, and business had pushed for a much longer period. The question that you've got to ask yourself is, if you reduce it down to 3 months, will it be seen as a this is a limitation of rights, and will it be seen as a constitutional limitation or not? And that's the key question. Now, there's no definitive answer to that. I can't say, well, if it goes from six to four, or from 4-3, you're likely to lose the constitutional case on that. But that's the question that one's got to ask. And of course, there are varying legal opinions about this. Okay, I think the dominant legal opinion is this, and I mean, I certainly have discussed with senior counsel views that think the banning of labor brokers is constitutional, okay? But I think they are very much in the minority, and they tend to be the ones that fought the case in Namibia and lost. But I think the dominant view is that a ban of labor brokers would be unconstitutional. That's the dominant view. What the Constitutional Court in Namibia was saying is there are less restrictive means to remedy the problems associated with labor brokers, and you must find a way to regulate labor brokers so that you, in essence, inverted commas, ban the problematic practices of labor brokers. And that's what they were in essence. That's the message that came out. Now, is 6 months too much or is it too little? That's a question you're going to have to debate. I think what was, bearing in mind that when you substitute an employee for maternity leave, it's 4 months at least in terms of the BCA, but a significant number of employers, particularly at the higher levels, have longer periods. You know, those kinds of things are all to be taken into account. And so I don't think that we can come here and definitively say, well, a move from 6-3 is a good thing or a bad thing. I think that you have to debate those policy implications in relation to that. But all I can say is you've got to bear in mind the legal challenges that will arise.
Are there further questions that you can...
Can I just supplement that very briefly? I agree with Anton's analysis, just so it's clear, on the legal provision of whether or not you can declare it constitutional or not based on how many months and so on. It's a very difficult question, and it's one that you'd get different answers from whoever. I mean, obviously, one tactical consideration that the committee or that the lawmakers have to decide is whether they want to an act that is going to only that is going to be subject to constitutional tests, and you're only going to find out once it's been its way through the courts that it's constitutional, or whether you can find a formulation that tackles the problems without the necessity of a constitutional challenge, or that is clearly on the side of being constitutional. But I just wanted to pick up that point really that Anton is making, is that all of these regulatory regimes around the world are trying to identify the problem, the abuse, and put their finger on the abuse, and none of them, very few, I don't have to say none because I can't say that categorically, but none of the international comparators think that the only way to deal with the abuse is to prohibit the triangular relationship. They all find ways of, whether it's through ensuring that the equal wages are paid, or that workers have security against dismissal, or that workers are treated as having longer-term contracts with the labor brokers, or they all have different ways of dealing with it, but they're trying to tackle the abuse, the problems that have arisen, rather than to say that the practice can be stopped somehow. There was another point that I've forgotten, Chair, and you probably think I've said enough anyway.
Yeah, Oksalayo. I don't know what is that in English. But you know, when all is said and done, the reason why we are here is because there had been abusive practices, and those abusive practices were possible because there were loopholes in the law. That's why we're doing refining, making amendments, redefining things, you know, so that this malpractice, this abuse should come to an end. We are here because there have been abuse of the system. We are not here. This is not just an intellectual discussion, debate. That no, and we have had this loss for a long time. Let us just have a review and see if they are still relevant. It's because there were problems on the ground. It's because workers who were employed by labor brokers were cheated out of their salaries, abused. I know of an old man in the Western Cape who was a bus driver for 10 years. And he's in his house, when you get in the house, there's a big photo of him washing the bus with a broom and a hose pipe. He loved that bus so much. But when he died, the family was given 1 month's salary. And the bus company said, no, it doesn't work for them. He works for some transport something. And there was no benefits at all. All what he was getting was his salary. It's out of this kind of issues that we ended up having to do a re-look at the law. And the people driving, these are the workers themselves, who are at the receiving end of the laws that we are making. So most of what we'll do, we are going to get our cue from public hearings again. Those are people who are going to give us direction on what is this that they think will work for them. We'll have public hearings and we'll take it from them. Thank you very much. Is there some things that you'd like to say before we move on to the next item? Are we okay? All right, let's move to the... Yeah. Basic conditions of employment. Are we all okay, honorable members? Can we move forward?
Thank you.
All right.
Chair, we'll take it in the same way that we did previously. This, I don't think, is as complex as the other one. The First Amendment that is of significance is the amendment to Section 33A. 33 capital A, that is, which is entitled Prohibited Conduct. 33 capital A. Chairperson, is it possible that we can do this in exactly the same way that we go through the Memorandum of Objectives, that's on the back of the Act?
Yes.
And then... we've got it here in front of us.
Okay.
So that we can actually see where you are. You could say point number one or point number two or wherever, what point...
Oh, ah, okay. Yeah. Well, I'm on point number 3.2. I'm not going to go to the substitution of definitions. I don't think they're of particular policy significance. I think they're more technical. It's prohibited conduct, and in essence, let me explain the problem, but it raises a number of very serious difficulties in the drafting. In essence, what we had is a situation where in some companies you would be employed and then you had to pay for your uniform, and then you had to pay for this and that, and you had to buy from the employer's supplier. And in that way, they would take a whole range of money back from your wages. and this is highly exploitative types of practices. I think this was quite common, as I understand it, in the security industry in particular, where when you joined, you had to buy your uniform from the employer or the employer's supplier, and then that cost you a whole range of money. So
What is being prohibited is requiring or accepting any payment from an employee or potential employee in respect of their employment or the allocation of work to the employee. So that's what's being prohibited. I would doubt there are many people that would have a problem with that kind of prohibition. The social partner certainly didn't have any problem with it, and there was complete consensus on the issue. The difficulty was really and the second one is the purchase of goods from the employer. So it's, you can't actually have to pay the employer to get work from the employer. You can't have to, you're prohibited from buying goods from the employer, like the uniform and those kinds of things. What we had to specifically look at, and the concern, was that this restriction doesn't apply to schemes in terms of which employees receive financial benefit through the purchase of goods, products, or services at a fair and reasonable price. So the concern there was around funeral schemes, pension provident, medical aid type schemes, which are, you know, from a social point of view, legitimate services that might be connected to the employer. I see we might be washed out of here quite soon.
Quite heavy out there, yeah.
So quite clearly the intention is to try and prevent that those kinds of unacceptable practices that are being implemented by some employers. What has been made is the breach of this has been made a criminal offence. Okay. Now, that is quite a significant move because, remember, in 1995, the attempt was to decriminalise labour legislation, but the government and the social partners, I think, have agreed that this is such a problematic practice that it should be accorded with some kind of criminal offence associated with it.
How does this affect William? Thank you. Sorry, Chairperson. This particular clause, how does this affect farm workers who buy uniforms, rent and house for the houses and all of that stuff? How does it affect them?
May I add to that, Chair?
Honourable Vanderbilt.
Uniforms. I think you're meaning safety.
The reason why I have to say this names of people, it's so that when people take capture this, they know who is speaking,
rather than
try to listen to your voice.
No. Thank you, Chair. Now, so also, we quite often people are far from places such as shops and so on, and they have to buy produce, etc., from stores being run by the company or the owner that they work for. So if you could just expand on those types of situations, because there has been something which has been open to abuse for quite a while.
Honourable Albert.
Thank you. Yes, I'm just thinking now, you know, you have situations where people, like the car guards that you have today, I regard them as permanent employees because they sometimes stay for long periods at a venue where they work. And they have to buy their uniforms, they have to pay. They actually pay rent or some sort to actually work there. They have to pay for the right to work there, to actually, you know, look after cars and get tips from people who park there. And there might be similar situations of other types of work. And I just want to know whether that's also covered under this. Thank you.
Just the last question first, Chair. Yes, I think they would be, I mean, if they're employees, they would be covered. Unless they're independent contractors, but that's been described by some people as a cruel hoax that's sometimes played out on workers. So I don't think that. I think if they're employed, they couldn't be required to pay for the right to work because this provision would preclude that. On the question about buying from shops, it definitely precludes the employer from requiring them to purchase any goods, products, or services from the employer, or from anybody else nominated by the employer. So it's very clear on that. The difficulty comes in with things like, Anton used the example of a uniform. There are many employers that have a uniform policy, and they say that, for example, if uniform, so if this says, well, then you provide the uniform free of charge to the worker. Then the question arises, well, then you get into all sorts of arguments about, well, does the employee have to, if it's provided by the employer, does the employee have to look after the uniform? And if the uniform gets lost or torn, does the employer discipline the employee for damage to its goods, or does the employee themselves take personal responsibility and ownership and say, I'll replace it if it is damaged or goes missing? So you get into what seem to be petty arguments about things like that, but apparently in some employers this is a major cost item that leads to problems. And so it's a point of tension. And most people would probably say a reasonable uniform allowance, or certainly if you add it onto the top of a minimum wage when you started, but you then require the employee to buy the uniform. Probably most people would end up saying if you engage them at a workplace level, they don't really mind that. That's not a bad option. So there's a risk. There are some risks here. And the other complicated ones are this point about what is permitted under subsection 2. If you look at the section itself, it's okay if you have a scheme that the employee must participate in, because many employers join and then it says you must join the medical aid and provident fund. And workers might not want to join it, but that's only permitted if the employee receives a financial benefit from participating in the scheme. Now, does an employee receive a financial benefit from participating in a medical aid scheme? A financial benefit? I don't know. They can go to a hospital if they have an accident, but is that a financial benefit? So there's a risk of a bit of a debate there, and the price must be fair and reasonable of the medical scheme. That's fair enough. But there's quite a lot of anxiety, I think, being created in those benefit schemes that most people think are reasonable and that most people would think workers also find reasonable. And they only work if you make it compulsory. You can't have a medical aid scheme that's not compulsory, because otherwise it doesn't get enough cost, enough installments for to cross-subsidize those who are sick and those who are well. So I think that one just has to be cautious. There's no doubt this section cuts out any idea that workers must pay for their jobs, and it stops the company store. The bit that is more controversial are the schemes that appear to be designed for the benefit of workers.
This company store thing. Yes, thank you. Van der Westen makes a point that in a remote place where you have 25 kilometers or so and there's no shop, there's nothing, and the employer has this little kiosk where he sells bread and matches and candles and whatever, what option does the employee have? If he or she doesn't buy from that store, he has to walk 25 kilometers to another store. What happens in that situation if you completely prohibit that? Because I think it now puts the employee in double jeopardy.
He's allowed to buy. The section doesn't prohibit it. It says the employer can't require him to, so he must have a free choice.
All right.
The workers have a free choice to buy from the company store.
Okay. All right. Then he's fine.
The problem with this thing now is that it works like a nightclub or pubs,
yes,
where you can bring a bottle from outside.
Yes.
Say, we all drink alcohol here,
yeah,
but it must come from within the house. Mm. And in our pub, a bottle is 300 rand more than if you buy it at the bottle store. Mm. That's why they enforce it. Mm. Now, the problem with the farm shops, it's, they are not meant to help the workers. They are meant as a small business within a business and to keep the money in the family, not outside. You'll find that on the farms there, the farmer who is the man runs the farm and the wife runs the shop. And for the shop to make money, is that the money moves from the husband's account to the account of the shop, which is the wife's shop. Then what it means is that then the money doesn't move from the family and the workers do not get it. Even if there's a shop next door that sells things cheaper, you can't go and buy from that shop. Goods from that shop are not allowed on this farm. I think that's why the law came in to be, to say if you are satisfied with those prices, and they are seen to be reasonable, because satisfaction is something else. You can be satisfied with something because it is linked to your job. You say the prices are good, you can't even complain about them, because if you complain, you lose your job. So people say, no, we think they are reasonable because of the distances. But, I mean, there are lots of arguments. We can go into some of these arguments when we debate the issues at a later stage. But the idea is to ensure that this kind of abuse does not recur. Now, in terms of enforcement of that, who is going to do that? Who is going to ensure that the prices are the same as the prices in the general dealer, in the, you know, the nearest town? And what is going to be the fun then of running this shop if there's not going to be any profit? Because the profit will mean that if you buy from the spa, then you need to add something on top to make profit. We are living in the profit system. So, yeah, I think those are some of the things that we need to look into. Honorable Williams.
I just want some clarity. You said that this, if this section was breached, it was a criminal offence. I'd like to know, how does the employee pursue that if it is breached? Do they go to the police station and say section 3.2 of the Basic Conditions of Employment Act is broken, please send a policeman around and arrest my employer?
They're filling the press at 1 rand more. Call the police. That was Honorable Williams. Yep. I mean, that's always been a problem, the question. So, you look at how the public service purchases. In Limpopo, 18 of coke that is sold for 8 rand or 7 rand something. In Limpopo, when the government buys it, it's 30 rand a can. And that is fair.
Chair, just to answer that question, I mean, the typical method where we've had employment offences or offences for breaches of the Basic Conditions of Employment Act was that you go to the Department of Labour and the Department of Labour prosecutes rather than the individual worker prosecutes. It doesn't mean that the individual worker can't lay a complaint to the police, but I suspect if they did, I don't think your average police station would know anything about it. there's an implicit underlying issue, which is that the previous BCA did away with the idea that it was criminal offences not to pay leave or whatever, and put the onus on the Department of Labour's Enforcement Inspectorate. But there's currently a big policy shift where effectively the Department of Labour is saying we're not able to do this successfully, so they want to put in offences again. But I think the question that you will ask yourself is the worker actually more likely to have the provision complied with if it's an offence, or is it, you know, is there some other way? One of the arguments is that the Labour Inspectorate should be given much more money and much more resources and much more staff to go and inspect at all of the farms and wherever else these provisions are being breached, and that's the most effective way to enforce them. But that's another debate. It's coming up in these amendments.
Should we move on then? The next section, I think, is a section dealing with
with the prohibition of work by children. And those are all consensus provisions. I mean, there's no debate or disagreement from the social partners in relation to these areas. It broadens it and brings South Africa's provisions in line with the international legislation or the ILO provisions. And I'm not going to go through it in particular because I think most of it is quite, it's broadening the notion of, first of all, employment to work. In other words, there's prohibitions in relation to children working as opposed to prohibitions of children being employed. And that's the main thrust of it as far as I can see for your purposes. I'm not going to go into it in specific detail unless you have some questions in relation to it, because I think it's uncontroversial.
May I ask, what happened to the children who are in communication, advertisement, and blah, blah, blah? Does it? I've seen babies there advertising nappies and other things. Does it affect what? What are the implications?
Age is an advantage there.
No, there are specific clauses that allow for that kind of thing to take place, but are regulated. So there are exceptions to it.
The odd questions also, whether you employ a child to you give pocket money for washing a car, for example. I think most people accept that those are not the kind of offence required, and then the hard cases are when they live on a farm and they start working in the farm shop on weekends because they want to get pocket money, and then that, you know, they probably cross a line. But some people find that those lines are quite hard to draw within families and within family businesses sometimes. Mm. But those are actually not, the Act doesn't try and regulate all that detail. It's actually, and the changes that are being made are not going to change that kind of a difficult, hard case, I don't think. And I think they just bring it more into line with the international conventions. But they do, by saying not employ, it does say may not require permit a child to work, which does appear to go further than to be employed, because the child who works for pocket money, you might say, I'm not employing them, I'm just doing a bit of a deal. That you're only going to get your pocket money if you do some chores around the house or in the business. But the prohibition, by saying they can't work, it is the international standard, and it says you actually can't allow them to work. What is work as opposed to chores?
Yeah. Yeah, we've got to be careful here not to really put ourselves in a situation which is going to be untenable. My wife is a teacher, you know, so these little guys, 12-year-olds, teach, and they say, we'll clean your car, and she gives them $20 or $25. This, in terms of this, that shouldn't be done, because cleaning a car is work. But the little guy wants a 25 range because he wants to go buy himself something that he's going to use for school. So we are on tricky ground here, I think.
I'll say that I think the... You know, there are instances on the farms. That's from my experience as a person who grew up in a farming area and rural areas, the rural farming towns around us. That if your family stays on a farm and the farm school that goes up to standard 4 and you stay on the farm, go to school Monday to Friday, after completing standard 4, you've got no reason again to be on that farm because you are not of school going age in that particular area. Now, your family must just start justifying to the farmer why you should remain on the farm, because you are a grown-up. There's no longer school for you in this area, and the nearest school is about 10 kilometers away, and it's highly unlikely that there will be a child who will travel that 9, 10 kilometers to the nearest school. So for you to continue staying on this farm, you've got to work. So there have been those kind of conditions, and I think the law actually takes into cognizance those kind of problems and try to secure those children who are forced to work on the farm so that they can continue staying there to justify their continued presence on the farm after completing grade 4. Honorable Williams.
Chairperson, I think these questions about washing cars and stuff are covered. It says here that Clause 3 seeks to mirror Section 28 of the Constitution that prohibits work and services of children that are inappropriate for a child and that places risk on the child's well-being. And I'm assuming they're talking about missing school, but I don't think cleaning a car places is a risk on the child's well-being. So that's why they've probably just left it out, because the Constitution also, I mean, that section of the Constitution is very broad, but generally children get pocket money for doing chores, and I think that would be covered under that section there. Thank you.
I think even in the children's rights, they talk about the children, their rights and obligations, and part of the obligation is that there is house chores that children have to do. Otherwise, a child will refuse even to wash their own underwear and say, I'm a child, so you must wash my undies and everything. You know? So,
well, Chair, that's exactly the problem. The point I tried to highlight was that in many instances, it's the children who say, Dad, I want to clean your shoes because I want to go to the movie. So you say, well, 10 pairs of shoes, and no problem. You know, you give him $10 or whatever, stuff like that. Now, the work, you know, the substitution of employ for work, it's work anyway, and somebody could make an issue about that. That's really what I'm saying. Maybe the word work can be used against us in terms of the good intentions that we have about protecting children. It could go far beyond, and somebody could make an issue of that.
I think we should move.
Can I just? No, I mean, I was just flagging the thing.
Can I just make one point?
Yes, sir.
I think the point about Section 28 of the Constitution is important. Section 43 of the BCA amendments mirrors that, and it says, the 43 says, a person must not require or permit a child to perform any work or provide any services that are inappropriate for a person of that age, that places at risk the child's well-being, education, physical or mental health, or spiritual, moral or social development. So I don't think it excludes, it includes the situation of cleaning shoes for your dad so he can get pocket money. What it does exclude is the kind of Nike example of children of 7 years of age making shoes from 10 hours a day. It also provides for regulations to be made by the minister in relation to placing conditions in relation to those issues. So I think it is covered there, and that those examples where it probably is in the interests of the moral and social development of the child to clean shoes for some pocket money is not prohibited.
Section 35, Section 55 of the DCA,
paragraph 3.4 on the memorandum, sectoral determinations. Now remember that a sectoral determination, in South Africa we don't have a minimum wage or minimum terms and conditions like in the United States. I mean, if you listen to or watch lots of American movies, you'll know that, what's it, $4 an hour is the kind of minimum wage that you have in the United States. We don't have a minimum wage. What we rather have is what we call sectoral determinations, which are determinations for a sector which the minister publishes, which set minimum terms and conditions of employment for that particular sector. Okay, so we have a sectoral determination, for example, for domestic workers, which sets the minimum wage in that particular sector. And we have a number of sectoral determinations, for example, security industry, and generally those industries where there is no collective bargaining that takes place or collective bargaining that's not sufficiently representative of the sector. The problem is that there are many employees that fall through the net because there aren't sectoral determinations that cover each and every sector. So there are sectors where there is just no minimum terms and conditions of employment that are set. And this provision gives the minister the opportunity to create what they call an umbrella sectoral determination, covering employers and employees who are not covered by any other sector, a sectoral determination, or by a bargaining council collective agreement. So this would be a sectoral determination that covers, for example, I don't know, hey?
Car guards,
yeah, or if they are employees. I don't know, drivers of motorbikes. The pharmacist, if it's not covered by another sectoral determination or another collective agreement. And this would mean that the minister would be able to then set minimum, an absolute minimum in relation to those kinds of things. And in addition, this sectoral determination, the powers that have been granted to the minister in relation to this, are to also prohibit or regulate subcontracting of work. And in addition, to create a situation for a threshold of representativeness for a registered trade union, to have organizational rights of access to employers' premises, and stop orders. So in the sectoral determination, in a sectoral determination, the minister may also regulate, to a certain extent, organizational rights. And then there is also the sectoral determination for the agricultural sector, which may specify methods for determining the value of a labor tenant's right to occupy or use part of a farm for the purposes of the Land Reform or Labor Tenants Act. So there are a number of provisions here that increase the minister's powers, and I'll just go through them. An umbrella sectoral determination, in other words, a sectoral determination where other sectoral determinations don't apply or there's no other collective agreement or bargaining council. Then to prohibit or regulate subcontracting, and then a threshold of representativeness for two organizational rights, that's the stop order right and the right of access, and the value of a labor tenant's right. And then the last one, which is rather controversial and opposed by business, is the question of determining minimum increases of remuneration. And what do we mean by that? Is that in
Yeah, minimum increases of remuneration. Sorry, sometimes I get confused between all the drafts that I've seen as to what was eventually agreed. The minimum increases of remuneration are the following. Usually a sectoral determination determines the minimum that you can pay. So I think might say, okay, the minimum you can pay a domestic worker is 700 rand a month. And that would be the minimum. But what we actually find is that that is such a low minimum that there are very, very few that are paid at that minimum level, very few domestic workers. The vast majority are at much higher wages. So instead of just being able to increase the minimum from, say, 700 to 800 in the next year's sectoral determination, the minister may also be able to say, you'll increase from 700 to 800 rand as the minimum, but all domestic workers must at least get a 5% increase. So whatever you get, whatever you're getting, if you're getting 1,000 rand, you must at least get a 5% increase. That's a minimum increase. And that's what is envisaged. So it becomes not just a prescribed minimum wage, but a prescribed minimum increase.
Okay.
I'll let you ponder.
Thank you. Chief, may I just ask? What sometimes happens is when, say, for example, two companies merge, they might find that in the one company, a secretary or a cleaner is earning a higher salary than in another company. And one way of dealing with that was in the past to sort of hold back or fix the best paid people's remuneration so that the others can grow up to that level. Will that still be allowable, or how do you deal now in future with cases like that, or where, for example, you find that a specific job is no longer so much in demand and the general rates of remuneration for that specific expertise or whatever you bring to the workplace has fallen, and how can you get back to a market-related situation if you have a minimum or a guaranteed, what do you call it, aanpassing every year?
Honourable William.
Thanks, Chairperson. I just want to know the last point you raised, why it was controversial, because the sectoral determinations, for instance, in the ones that do exist, like in the farming sector, they have increases every year, and it's published that next year they'll get 2% or whatever the figure is. Now, why is it so controversial if it's already happening in other sectors? Or is this covering all sectors or just the sectors that fall through the gaps? I'm a bit confused by this section 3.4. Is it just the people that fall through the gaps or is it for across all the sectors? Thank you.
Chair, maybe just to pursue that. Thank you. Just to pursue that line of thought. The other issue that rears its head mostly is employers who say the sectoral determination is unaffordable for them. Question is, last week we were discussing the exclusions, small companies with 2 million, Does this still apply here, those exclusions?
Can I try and deal with those, Jim?
Yeah.
If I could deal with Honourable Williams's question first, because it's a more conceptual question about how it overall applies. At the moment, as Anton said when he introduced, we don't have a national minimum wage, but whether you have a minimum wage or not will depend on whether you're in a sector where there is an industry bargaining agreement that sets sets a minimum wage, or a sectoral determination has been made for your sector. But a sectoral determination is made for a particular industry. So just to take an example, so that covers a large proportion of workers in the country, industry minimum agreements or industry sectoral determinations. The umbrella determination would apply by definition to everybody not covered already by one of those two. So the idea of an umbrella determination is that the minister can say, other than where you've already got it prescribed by agreement or sectoral determination, this is the minimum wage. Now, that's actually, nobody objects to that principle. And the effect of that change, if made, would be that we would have a national minimum wage that would have a different amount per sector, depending on which sector you're in. I think that's generally regarded as, if you call it a safety net or a minimum standard below which nobody in the country is allowed to employ, it would have that effect. Its biggest impact obviously would be if there are parts of the economy, domestic workers and farm workers are now covered by sectoral determinations, but if there are other parts of the economy, shop assistants, scooter riders or whatever, that aren't covered by, that are currently still paid very, very low wages, they would be covered by that. So that's how it works. The controversial thing is setting actual increases rather than minimum increases on minima, because where the underlying philosophy is that by sectoral determination you set, so the minister goes along and says, this is the least anybody can pay. But businesses and unions are able to differentiate through bargaining whether they should receive more or less than that. Now, if an employer over the years has come to a point where it pays 50% more than the sectoral determination, or even 100% more, it pays double the level, the amounts paid in the sectoral determination. The question then is, should the minister tell that employer what the increase must be for the next year, or can that employer say, we're no longer competitive because many of our competitors are just paying the industry minimum and we don't want to give a pay increase this year? And the increase on minimums, it means the minister is coming along and not only saying this is the least that must be earned in the industry, but we're guaranteeing even if you earn double or 1.5 or just more than the minimum, you must get a 5% or a 7% or an 8% increase. So there's a contention that that breaches the general principle of setting thresholds and then allowing bargaining to determine higher or lower rates above that. Then just on the, to deal with the question on Van der Westhuizen about the secretaries, if you've merged two companies, can you then keep, obviously Labour would say, well, we want to increase everybody to the highest level. The business might say, well, we can't afford that. We'll let everybody come somewhere in the middle. Can it hold back on wage increases? If those people are employed in a category covered by a sectoral determination and the sectoral determination sets a minimum increase, then even the ones who are highest and you're trying to hold back would have to receive the same increase. So the only way you'd be able to close the gap is by giving bigger increases to the ones below, which Labour would be happy with. I think business's position is, well, Labour's entitled to demand that, and that's the typical thing that you actually bargain and you try and argue about, and you might even have a strike over it if you can't agree, but business says that the law and sectoral determinations shouldn't regulate that kind of thing if it's all happening above the minimum level. They're saying the sectoral determinations should manage what is the acceptable entry level for that sector. And then the last point about exemptions. Exemptions would apply as before. So any sectoral determinations, are there exemptions? No exemptions from sectoral determinations. They're set at the minister has to set them after consulting the Employment Conditions Commission, and employers can't ask for less, to pay less than the sectoral determination minimum.
And therein lies the problem, because we keep on getting these things, and people saying, now I have to lay, or I'm employing 10 people, now I'll have to lay off 3 to keep up and stuff like that. How do we tackle this kind of thing? Because the last thing we want is for anybody to lose their job because of a piece of legislation.
I think that the understanding was is that sectoral determinations and generally are very, very low a base. So that exemptions weren't required from it. Whereas with a collective agreement that is extended, it may be required because you've got certain employers determining that and not other employers. Mm-hmm. So the policy considerations were that it's quite obvious that you need the exemption process with collective bargaining that is extended, but with sectoral determinations, generally they're very low. The issue around minimum increases as opposed to just simply minimum rates, I think the motivation from government, as I understood it, and supported by Labour, was that anomalies are created, such differences are created, that it may be necessary, and that you wouldn't, difficult examples that business has put out would always be obviously subject to review in terms of the Administration Act, that it has to be a reasonable decision by the minister in relation to those kinds of things. The issue in relation to amalgamations, I think at the end of the day is, I mean, Chris's answer is absolutely right, but it's very unlikely to occur, given that sectoral determinations are in, you know, only in specific sectors, and those are generally sectors that require a hand from government to assist with the determination of minimum services, minimum terms and conditions. But I mean, if you had a minimum increase for the umbrella, the difficult scenarios can arise, but this is an attempt to increase the hand of government in relation to vulnerable workers and workers that are in a difficult situation. It's not an attempt to try and create difficulties for, the ordinary manufacturing employer. It's hardly likely to occur in that.
Tim, I just
Minimum,
in law, when you speak of a minimum increase, is that a fixed amount, or could it also be a percentage? Because I think part of the problem that many people have is with percentages, in the sense that a percentage opens the gap between the best paid and the lowest paid, whereas a fixed amount would assist to close that gap. So what is meant under law by minimum increase?
It could be either. It's not specified.
Your point is right. If the minister says, well, I don't know if it's your point, Honourable, that's what I said. If the minister says minimum increases in the whatever sector it is, in the security sector, shall be 5%, then unless that determination excludes the managing director, the managing director is also entitled to get 5%. So it would apply all the way up. So you'd then be expecting or hoping that the minister only specifies minimum increases for lower pay levels. But that would become a matter entirely in the discretion of the minister making the sectoral determination.
Right. Shall we move on?
Yeah, let's move on.
The next area is the area of Section 68 to 73, and again was there was some disagreements among the social partners, particularly with business, in relation to this, and this relates to the questions of the enforcement of the BCA and sectoral determination. Now, what in essence has been put forward is, and I'll rather say it from the point of view of government, is an attempt to try and make the enforcement provisions a lot simpler. Okay? Because at the moment, the perception is at least that there are major problems with the enforcement of the BCA and the minimum terms and conditions, and that those problems
are not only problems associated with the administration in the Department of Labor, but also problems with the somewhat elaborate processes that they needed to go through in order to ensure compliance. And part of that was that the process up to now has been a process in which you have to obtain a compliance order, or you issue a compliance order to the employer, and the employer can then appeal against that compliance order to the Director General, and only after that can then you apply to the Labour Court to enforce that compliance order. And the general proposition that has been put forward is to make the issuing of the compliance order a discretionary issue for the labour inspector. So you don't have to, once a compliance order has been issued, it doesn't have to, you don't have a right of appeal to the Director General. Is that correct, Chris? So the concern that has been expressed is, well, wouldn't it prevent a whole lot of litigation around this if there was an appeal process? Because otherwise small employers and large employers have to incur legal costs by going to court to deal with their objections to the compliance order, whereas they could do it through an administrative process beforehand. The problem with that, from the department's point of view, is that it just draws out the process. It's much more lengthy, and you have a process of continual lack of enforcement of the BCA and sectoral determination. So what has been suggested is rather that the compliance process and the appeal on that has been dropped. But obviously, what will happen is that the labour inspector will attempt to obtain a compliance order first from the defaulting party. But they're not required to get that compliance order first.
That would be nice, at least you know where to look, you know. Yes.
Honorable Buttal.
I think we've touched on this, Chris, earlier on, that because of the shift in terms of now criminalizing certain actions or omissions by employers and stuff, we're now putting a lot of demands on the inspectorate, the labor inspectorate, and as you said, you know, more resources, more that, but I think additional to that, we're giving the inspectors a lot more power, and as you know, when you do that, you have the question of who polices the police. So how do we address that kind of thing? Because it's about first the inspectorate being well-equipped and adequate and all those things that are necessary, but also integrity and all sorts of things that go with that.
Thank you. I'm very confused now because you started off saying something and then you changed it halfway through. So I just want to know, again, in very simple one sentence, does this mean that the inspectors go out there and they serve a compliance order, and then the appeal process, does the compliance order have to be compliant with while the appeal process is happening? Or, I mean, what does this section actually change? Because at the moment you get things like, what's it called, an undertaking, and then a compliance order, and then there's all these different processes before actually anything happens at the moment as we sit here. So what exactly does it change? What is the bottom line on this point? Yeah, that's what I want to know. Thank you.
What it does is there are two main changes. The one is the change to say that labour inspectors are no longer obligated to try to get a written undertaking and to try to secure voluntary compliance.
the structure previously was that labor inspectors must first try and persuade the employer to give a written undertaking. And only if those voluntary attempts failed would go through the formal imposing of compliance. Now it says the labor inspector may try to secure a written undertaking, which means they're not obliged to. They can just issue a compliance order if they want to. Now, where business and everybody, where businesses, what business doesn't mind is saying if a person gives an undertaking to comply and doesn't comply with it, you shouldn't then have to go and issue a compliance order and various other things. They accept that in order to short-circuit it, if the employer's actually agreed, I agree that I'm not complying and I agree that I have to pay X to these workers or whatever it is, that if that's not complied with, that undertaking, it can go straight to court. What is a problem for business is the second part is first of all, that that's not obligatory to try and get the undertaking. And secondly, if the labor inspector just issues an undertaking, a compliance order rather, so the labor inspector is now sitting in his office and he says, do I go out to the plant and try and persuade the employer to comply, or shall I rather say my diary is a bit full and I'm going to just issue a compliance order? When he issues a compliance, assuming he decides, actually, I just don't have time to go out there today, so he issues a compliance order without engaging with the employer first. The next step for the employer is to appear in court. Whereas until now, the next step for the employer was to object and say, no, you've now issued this compliance order, it's wrong, I don't agree with it. You haven't heard me explain to you, I'll show you proof of payment, or I'll explain to you how my shift system works. So the first opportunity the employer now gets to do that is in court. And so what has been dropped is the objections to the compliance order and the appeals against the compliance order. Both of those get dropped. Those were different stages where initially the employer could object to the labor inspector or to the director general, I think. And if or they could appeal. I can't remember exactly how those two mechanisms worked. But the idea then was it was only after all of that that the matter would go to the labor court. And what the Department of Labor has said is, we don't have the resources to spend all our time trying to persuade recalcitrant employers to comply. So if they've got an explanation, let them give it to the court. Businesses view that that is the wrong approach because actually they believe that many, many non-compliance. They don't, I mean, it must be accepted. If there's an employer that's just ducking and diving, well, nothing's going to solve that problem until the court orders the employer to comply. But what business says is that very often labor inspectors don't, for example, understand how the payroll system reflects leave on the payslip. And so a worker goes to the department and says, I haven't been paid my leave pay. And so what does the labor inspector do? Without engaging with the employer, might well issue compliance orders that are all going to get subsequently set aside in court. And what business says is that it forces employers in the first instance to spend the resources of court cases, and that it's going to lead to an escalation and may even result in cost orders against the Department of Labor. So what business says is that the international, in fact, the South Africans' own obligations in the Decent Work Program, the country ILO country program on decent work, says resources to the Labor Inspectorate, resources to the Labor Inspectorate. If you want to enforce workers' rights, get the inspectorate working properly with top quality, properly trained staff. And actually the department, I think I've actually heard from the department side saying that's true, but in actual fact, in practice, they say what happens is we get good inspectors and then they get poached by the private sector to go and work in their compliance office. So it is a real problem that there is a problem with resources for the labor inspectorate. But as I said, I mean, I don't want to bang on business's point of view. They say you're short-circuiting those intervening measures when actually you would resolve a lot of the problems. And one of the things that I think has crept into the memorandum but not the drafting is a suggestion that actually the CCMA, a conciliation arbitration type process, might be the most effective way of identifying these things, so that when you go to conciliation, you actually have a discussion and you show payslips and everybody then agrees what's happened. and if you don't, the CCMA could be used to arbitrate it as a method, as an alternative route of enforcement. But I think the parties, there isn't consensus on that. It's referred to an explanatory memorandum. There's no consensus on it, and it would have resource implications for the CCMA, for the Commission as well, which currently it would suddenly add what's effectively supposed to be being done in the Labour Inspectorate. It would suddenly shift that into the CCMA, which would be a massive increase in its caseload. At the moment, absent compliance by employers with whatever compliance orders are issued, then the Labour Court is going to experience a very significant increase in its caseload, and it's going to have to set aside a series of courts, scheduled courts, to deal with compliance issues.
Ed, sorry if I was confusing earlier. I think the one answer that has been put forward by government in relation to businesses' concerns is that there is no reason why, if there is that kind of confusion, that representations aren't made to the department, but you don't need to specify that that is going to be the procedure in the Act, so that it has to be followed with each and every case. That is the one concern.
I see. I should send you this stuff.
Tomorrow we have that meeting after we have our meeting with Stuart Farrell.
Actually not, because Davi just sent me. It looks like we have to just tell Stuart that we've got to go, because I think this is more important than Stuart's meeting can ever be. Let me just tell you what Davi sent through.
Davi sent through yesterday. He's got a bee in his bonnet that we must speak to a labor law expert.
That's right. That's the one. That's the thing.
And I'm fully supportive of that. I said to Davi, no, we are in the process of getting expert
advice. That's good for us. That's good for us. That's why.
At least if you want to get to meet Paul Benjamin, the guy that...
I don't know who they're getting, but to us it doesn't really matter. Any one of the experts is fine. These are good because they were drafted as being Paul did the RIA and stuff like that. But he says that they're setting up something for us. We should meet here at 10:30. Now, our meeting with Stu is normally 10. Yeah?
And I've got now this meeting set up with these other inspectors at 11:50.
So you mean you're going to miss this other thing? But if you can't make it, that's fine. As long as you're aware of it, because I will go with Davi to this other thing. I can be there.
But because you have two places at once.
We'll have to split the time. We're discussing it. Because you
can't. You know, there will probably be a committee meeting next week, but there will be no plenaries next week, I think.
The thing is, with our guys in the mini office, and I agree with them, this thing, remember, should have been done about this. This week we would have been having our media conference on the labor law, business, stuff like that, but we can't do it. Because we haven't consulted with our own things. But the important thing for us is that we need to have our ducks in a row before the public hearings happen, so that if need be, then our document can be included as part of the public hearings, that kind of thing.
Okay.
Yeah. But we're also looking at a media conference where we're going to state our case.
When are the public hearings going to come up?
We're not sure. Well, he just referred to them.
There's still a bit of time. Yeah.
But I think the thing is just to share this. Let's see about this then. So then I can do Davi tomorrow.
With the public hearings.
Where are they?
24th of July and onwards.
That's a long thing. Is that the one you just
that's
gave
two
me?
2 months from now.
Okay, but anyway, let's do the work. Anyway, that's fine. I didn't realize they've got it in there. Okay. Oh, that's nice. That's silly. It's super swag. So you do what you need to do tomorrow. I'll go with Davi, and you'll brief me. I'll brief you when you come back here. Because I think these other guys, clearly they're going to be taking the business perspective like Chris most of the time on these bills. Yeah, which is good. We need to hear that, because that's where we're coming. Now, that's fine. So, let's... Let's, I'll do school until 10:30, and I have to leave with
Gary. You don't know where that meeting is.
He hasn't mentioned it. He says, let's see, let me see, he says 11 tomorrow, possibly drive there. Gardens. He says what? It is in Gardens. What's Gardens?
Gardens
is
on the other side of
Parliament. No? Gardens.
Yeah,
the
Gardens.
If you go
Gardens
through just above it, the little place up there. So it's not too far. But
there,
he, yeah, he is at. Yeah. Oh. Okay. Yes.